Harper Audio presents Proof of Guilt by Charles Todd, performed by Simon Preble.
Chapter 1. Funchal Harbour, Madeira, the 3rd of December, 1916. He couldn't remember later what had taken him down to the harbour. Now, staring out at the masts of the C.S. Dacia, the British cable-laying ship, he found himself thinking about England. Dacia was said to be diverting the overseas cable in an attempt to deny the Germans access to it. Whether it was true or not, he didn't know. But she and the French gunboat Surprise had brought the war home to him in an unexpected and unwelcome fashion. England had been at war since August 1914, but Portugal, and by extension Madeira, had remained neutral in spite of a centuries-old alliance with Britain. In spite, as well, of clashes with Germany in the Portuguese colony of Angola in Africa. Neutrality was one of the reasons he'd decided to live here. His grandmother had been a Quaker by conviction, and he himself held strong views about war and the waste it brought in its wake. He turned to look upward. Madeira was volcanic, its climate temperate and its soil fertile. A paradise of flowers which his mother had loved. Clouds were beetling down the mountainside, concealing the heights, but on a promontory to the far side of the bay, he could still see the tower of his house. Three stories, like most in Funchal, and in his eyes far more handsome than the house where he'd grown up in Essex. It was his late grandfather, Howard French, his father's mother, who had introduced him to the wine business here. He'd come as a boy and stayed as a man. An exile, but a happy one. A flash spun him round to stare at the harbour, just as an explosion amidships sent a column of black smoke rising from Dacia. He was trying to think what could have happened aboard when another explosion rocked Surprise, and just above him, from the vantage point of the Grand Hotel grounds, someone was pointing and shouting, "There, look, it's a submarine!" The voice carried clearly this close to the water. He didn't lose time trying to see. He began to run, turning his back on the harbour as other explosions shook it. People were coming out of doorways, stopping in the streets to stare, calling to one another, unable to believe the evidence of their own eyes. He risked a glance over his shoulder and saw pillars of black smoke rising from Dacia, which had been hit again, and Surprise, and even Kangaroo, a third ship near them. Someone in the water was screaming, and he could hear other cries as the heavy smell of burning timbers wafted inland on the onshore breeze, making him cough. His offices were on the street just above the harbour. French and Trainer, exporters, handled Madeira, the fortified wine that had made the island famous. And if this shelling of the ships in the harbour was a precursor to an invasion, there was work to be done in a hurry. Sprinting across the street, where a few motor cars were halted and several carriages and drays had pulled up, their occupants transfixed by the burning ships, he passed a wild-eyed horse rearing in its traces, the odour of smoke terrifying it. In the doorway of the export house stood most of his employees, and those who couldn't crowd into the narrow space were at the windows, their faces nearly as shocked as he felt.
"Mr. Trainor," his foreman shouted in English, "what are they doing?"
"I don't know."
He pushed his way inside and ordered his people to follow him. His own office was in the front, overlooking the street. Behind the offices was the long space where the shop stood, and the heavy drays were kept. Above and beyond that, the cavernous rooms where great barrels of Madeira, coded by age and type, rested on their sides. And the high-ceilinged rooms with the kettles and vats and gauges that heated the wine, along with the smaller rooms where all the tools collected through centuries of winemaking were displayed. And at the very back, the long room where employees ate their meals, walls hand-painted by them down the generations and a source of much pride. Wood, all of them, and they were all vulnerable to fire. He stopped short, suddenly overwhelmed. What to do? It would take days, and at best would be a very risky task to move the wine. And as for the equipment, more days to disengage the pipes and lines that connected kettles to vats. An impossible task. Even if he managed it, where could he take an entire building to safety? Matthew Trainor stood there feeling helpless. Damn the Germans, and damn the war. Someone was asking him if Portugal had been attacked, and if it had fallen, if this was a prelude to invasion. Others were pleading with him to allow them to leave, to reach their families before it was too late. Torn, feeling for the first time in his life that he didn't know how to answer, he tried to collect his wits and act. Just as he was about to speak, someone poked his head into the doorway behind Trainer and shouted, "The U-boat! She's surfacing!" He went to the door to see for himself, and there was the U-boat in plain view, water still spilling across her hull, gun crews clambering out of the tower, racing across to the deck guns. The fort's harbour batteries, such as they were, hadn't opened up. By the time he looked back at the submarine, men had reached the guns, swung them around, and the shelling began. Not of the harbour, but of Funchal itself. He realized then that it was too late. "Go home, while you can," he told the employees waiting anxiously behind him. "If this is an invasion, stay at home. Don't do anything rash."
"What about the wine?" his foreman asked. "What are we to do?"
Trainer took a deep breath. "We'll just have to pray it survives.